Are we calling Shannon? Hi.
Downey, no, this is your team. Please meet us at Dairy Queen. We miss you, Downey. Please.
Welcome back, everyone. Another episode of The Shannon Show. A very special guest today. I welcome U.S. Army veteran Dr. Alan Dale Olson to the show. How are you doing?
I'm great.
That's great to hear. Thank you so much for joining me. It is an incredibly unique conversation I think we can have, and you know, I think a lot of people are going to enjoy listening to this, so I think it's very important.
By the way, you referred to me as an Army veteran, and that's correct, but I want to clarify what kind of Army veteran.
Please, yes.
I did 2 years of active duty in the occupation of Germany, yes. Too, but my Army experience was largely as a civilian, where I spent most of my time, almost 25 years, serving the Defense Department dependent schools as their liaison and communications coordinator for the Army. So I was an Army civilian for 30 years and an active duty Army veteran for 2 years.
Right.
How did you first, with Europe.
Mm-hmm. How did you first get involved in that? Because those were the early days of DODEA, correct? This wasn't a thing.
Yeah, the school system started in 1946. When I got there as a soldier in 1954, I'd already been a teacher for several years in the United States. And I saw that, hey, there's a school there. I wonder what's going on. And I wandered over to the school and the principal said, yes, we're part of the Army network. We have schools for the kids who are in the military. And I said, hey, how could I get into that? He said, well, you have to apply. I was still in uniform. He said, well, you have to make an application through the Department of Army procedures, and he showed me how to do that. So when I got out of the Army, went back to teaching, I heard the recruitment team was coming through the Chicago area. So I went in and talked to the recruiters and they said, hey, you're what we need, a veteran, a male. So they signed me up to go teach in Izmir, Turkey. And then from there, I taught for 6 years, took a break back in the States. A friend of mine got appointed to director of the whole European program and said he needed help and hired me to go on to serve the dependent school program in Europe.
Wow, that's interesting.
A lot of fun.
Yeah, I bet. So you said you were a teacher beforehand, which I think is very interesting. I talk to a lot of college and high school age students. I'm just interested, whenever you were that age, is teaching what you wanted to do? And when did you realize that's what you wanted to do?
I began to think about it in high school. I had a couple of teachers that really inspired me to do that. I had two parallel goals. I wanted to be a professional baseball player, actually got it. And I wanted to be a writer. And I went as far as a couple of training camp tryouts with a couple of teams. They put me on some minor league teams, but
that's awesome.
The writing, one of the teachers said, well, if you're a teacher, you get your summers off, you have weekends off, you have predictable vacations, and you'll have time to write. So I majored in two conflicting fields, it would seem. Physical education was my major with an English minor, because I wanted to stay active with PE activities and writing.
Yeah.
So I taught English and physical education for about 5 years in public schools.
That's awesome. Yeah, I played minor league baseball. That must have been a pretty neat experience back then. I can't imagine.
I like to say that one of the scouts for the Chicago Cubs said, son, you know, you're pretty good, but you're really not major league caliber, he said. Why don't you just go to that school job and let them move you to France and you can eat French food and croissants and wine, and that would be a much more lucrative career for you. So that's kind of how that evolved.
Whenever you were growing up, who were some of the people that you looked up to, some of your heroes?
Well, of course, I'm a Depression baby. I grew up during the Great Depression and did my adolescence in World War II.
Yeah.
So I was very impressed with people like Eisenhower and MacArthur. And the military heroes really appealed to me. I don't know why exactly.
Yeah.
And I liked some of the movie stars, and they didn't seem to be as controversial in their private life as some of our movie stars today. So I like going to see Tarzan, and I like Hopalong Cassidy and Cowboys you probably never heard of. And the athletes. I am watching I live near Chicago, so I got to see most of the teams that came in to play the Cubs and the White Sox. So my heroes are the athletes and the military leaders.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that a lot applies to a lot of people. So that hasn't changed too much, I suppose. When did you ultimately get drafted? How old were you then?
I was 24 when I actually entered service.
Yeah.
I began getting my deferments at age 21 because, A, they were allowing us to finish college before calling up our draft.
Yeah.
And then I went into teaching, and teachers were still considered essential personnel. So I had a 2 or 3 teaching deferments. But then as one of them began to loom heavily, I thought, you know, maybe I better write my own destiny. And I went to an Air Force recruiting office because all the former GI said, hey, you'll eat better and sleep better in the Air Force than you will in the foxholes of the Army. So the Air Force then sent me down to I don't know what they call it, a pilot training school in Randall, Illinois, where I spent a week with about 100 guys where we spent part of the day doing physical exercises and part of the day doing classwork. And every day, 4 or 5, 9 or 10 would drop off. And toward the end of the week, there were only 8 or 9 of us left. And when my turn came for my assessment, they said, well, probably you shouldn't be a pilot, but you can be a navigator. I thought that would be pretty good. I'll get in for 4 years, get out, and I will have been in the Air Force. But when I got back home, my draft notice had arrived, and the draft said that overrides enlistment, so I never did get to enlist. So they sent me off to Fort Chaffee and trained me as a forward artillery and a forward observer for the artillery. But I got even with them. When they sent me to Germany, I tried out for the 1st Division band and spent my 2 years playing with the band.
Sounds like
in the tent.
Did you play instruments before that?
Yeah, I had been in both high school and college.
Yeah.
Playing trombone.
That's great. What were your feelings about getting drafted? Obviously, I'm assuming there's a little bit of disappointment because you just put in all that work in the Air Force training. So how did you feel about it at the time?
Hard to describe that in terms of the modern view of the draft. And I'll give you a comment about that too. All of us guys, 17, 18 years old, especially when we were 13, 14 and the war was dragging on and we knew, hey, by golly, this is real. You know, this could affect me. I have to say we all were a little bit, well, I shouldn't say all. There's always a guy who's really gung-ho and wants to go out and do this sort of thing, run off and enlist. But most of us really, really were a little bit afraid of it, but we felt our duty. We didn't resist it. We didn't run off to Canada. We didn't. And of course, the war wasn't as controversial as the Vietnam War became either. But we willingly, if sometimes unhappily and reluctantly, went off to serve. And that's the way I would describe it now. But today, I have a somewhat different view of the draft. I still think it would be a good duty. But, you know, I grew up in an all-white rural Indiana community until I got drafted. I had never bunked with a black man. I had never met anybody from New York. I never knew a farmer from Nebraska.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, I'm with guys from all over the country, and we were all in it together. You know, we solved our problems together. We did training together. We played in the band together, black, Asian, Pacific Islander.
Yeah.
And it never occurred to us that it should be anything different. So I think serving and learning about one another has its value because in the partisan politics of today, we have people even in our Congress who have no idea what it's like to be in another profession or another field or from another country. So that's kind of the way I would describe my feelings back then at age 18, 19, 20. And as I said, I got deferred until I was 24. I was a late draftee. I was one of the old men in my basic training company. as yep. old as some of the cadre sergeants who were training us.
Wow. So how do you look back on the war as a whole? I mean, has your perception of it changed over the years? I mean, it's been such a long time. Do you look on it any differently?
Not really. I'm certainly not an advocate for a war. War represents a failure of something, either diplomacy or humanitarian, but at times it becomes necessary. And war is awful. It's terrible. And there's no other way to look at it. I served with a lot of military, mostly officers, who share that same feeling.
Yeah.
They appreciate serving. They appreciate doing their duty. They feel very patriotic without being flag-waving about it. But they have their cares and their regrets and recognize that war is awful.
That's interesting. There's so many movies made today about that time period and about the war. First question, do you ever watch any of them and compare to how it actually was? And then what's your view on that altogether?
I went through a period where I didn't look at them. I'm coming back to some of them now, partly for nostalgic reasons.
Yeah.
Because I worked at the headquarters for the Army in Europe for so long and became kind of an amateur historian and traveled a lot, visiting the war sites of World War II, that I now look at these movies to see how much of them I recognize and identify more sites and the locations and the interaction of the military with the civilian community than with the actual conflicts. But I still read widely about World War II and treasure the memories I have of visiting the sites where the wars were fought. Cersei, by the way, she may not have told you this, was born in Normandy, just not very far from the invasion beaches. So her first couple of years of life were spent right there in one of the most devastating conflicts in history.
Yeah, that must be an interesting feeling going back after you were there for a different purpose beforehand.
And for a while, my duties at the Army headquarters and then privately were leading tours through the beaches.
Oh, wow.
And Verdun, too, the World War I sites.
Wow.
So I'm something of an amateur historian with respect to World War I and World War II, more of a tourist about those two wars, but an appreciator of what went on and what they did and what they meant. Too bad the claim that World War I was the war to end all wars never came true, because that was what people really thought. Then, of course, President Truman said it would be necessary at the end of World War II to keep troops overseas for the duration for a while. None of us knew what the duration was. Here we are now, 75 years later, and we still have troops there.
Yeah. So what was it like coming home from the war, whenever the war was over and you came back home? What was that adjustment like for you?
Well, originally when I came back home from doing my active duty and got a job, I was just another guy back home. Practically everybody my age had been. And so there was no real hubbub about Korea broke out, but that went by me because I had already done my time and got out. Where I began to see change was after I'd gone back to Europe and was working for the military.
Yeah.
And in the 60s, the drug culture was just getting mainstream, and the civil rights movement was gaining national attention and protests. And on top of all that, the Vietnam War spelled out. So each time I'd go home, I'd see kind of a different attitude. The respect for the military, while not gone, was a little less enthusiastic.
Interesting, yeah.
There were guys my age who resented that we have to send troops to Vietnam. So the attitude had changed. I think I'm seeing a swing back to where the military is still one of the last universally respected arms of government, but not what it was during World War II when everybody was in it together.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you said you went to Turkey whenever you first became a part of DODEA. What were the early days of DODEA like, and personally for you teaching?
Well, the very early days were very interesting. People were very excited about what all this meant and what had to be done. And nobody was really quite sure how it was going to work or if it would work.
Yeah.
The schools had been in operation about 9 years in Germany and Japan. Mm-hmm. I went into the school system. In Turkey, they'd been open only 2 or 3 years. So we were still fairly new getting started in Turkey. The Navy had opened the base at Izmir, and then the Air Force took over when I arrived, not because I arrived there, but as I arrived there. So I was getting acquainted with Air Force officers and NCOs and kids. And it was fairly primitive. We had to boil our water to use it at home. There was no real housing for the military in Turkey. The school was in a former tobacco warehouse that still smelled of tobacco. Camel caravans were in the streets every day as we went back and forth to school. We had currency restrictions, things that we couldn't use our dollars for, and we had to use military scrip it was just a little complicated, we'll say.
But I bet, yeah.
The Turks were good to us at that time, and they appreciated having Americans there with the money to spend and protection to offer. And at that time, our relationships with Turkey were very good. The political scene was that if we wanted to take leave and go to Greece, for example, we had to get permission, and we had to, if we wanted to go to the Holy Lands, which a lot of us did, we had to carry certificates of baptism to prove that we were Christian. Wow. We couldn't go from Israel to Jordan or cross the borderline in Jerusalem without those permits. And sometimes we had to go back to the country we had left from and take a new flight and enter from another country. But all that sorted itself out in time.
Yeah.
In fact, for us young guys, it was kind of exciting.
It sounds complicated to say the least, though. I can understand why that's exciting. When did you have a family?
My wife and I were in Izmir for a year. We moved to Germany for a year.
Okay.
We moved to England for 2 years, and we moved to France for 2 years. And
it was
our second year in France that Circe was born.
Yeah.
So after Circe was born, we thought, well, we really need to raise her as an American. We need to go back to the States and, you know, and make her home. And that was kind of although we liked being in France, we liked being in Germany. I have to say something a little amusing. When I met my wife, I had already done my time in Germany and been in the army. I was telling her, we were talking about going over there to teach. I said, it was wonderful. You know, the Germans were great to us. It's a beautiful country, and the food is good, and the culture is great. You know, the opera, she was an art teacher. So I said, the art museums are right there in France and Germany. So when she married me and they sent me to Turkey, I went first and I wrote back and told her, well, it's not quite like Germany. And so when she got off the airplane and saw the camel caravans and the palm trees and see the harem girls and their beautiful shapely bodies instead of the peasants with their burkas and the carts and donkeys and manure and the cobblestone
street.
It's a bit of a culture shock. But then when we got to Germany, she realized that I'd been telling her the truth about my first time over there. Anyway, we decided we had to come back to the state. I'd become a principal in the school system by then.
Wow.
And I attracted the attention of both the director of the Air Force school system and the directors of the National Education Association in Washington. So when they heard that I wanted to come back to the States, they offered me a job in the publications division of the NEA in Washington.
Yeah.
And for 4 years, I oversaw or assisted with the overseeing of the publications program. Went to several meetings in the White House, met a couple of the presidents, went to the White House Conference on Education in 1964. But about that time, the former Air Force director got caught up in the politics of consolidating all of the school systems in Europe under one director. So the Air Force, the Navy, and the Army schools were all going to merge under a directorate run by the Army. Yeah. And my former boss got appointed director of the Army system. He said, Ole, I need help. Why don't you come back overseas? So we did. And the European program at that time ranged from sub-Saharan Africa to the Arctic Circle, from the Azores to Bahrain. So we had over 220 schools and enough students that we would be larger than the school system of St. Louis, covered the geographic area 2.5 times the size of the continental United States. So I could see why he needed help.
Yeah, that's no easy thing to manage. What were some of the difficulties with managing that large of a scale?
Biggest problem was communication. Didn't have cell phones, internet. Maybe that was an advantage in some ways. And we were merging the support systems. The Air Force was learning how to support Army agencies. The Army agencies were learning how to deal with the Navy and the Air Force and the Marine Corps and the State Department, because they were sending their kids to our schools too. And the supply system. No matter how you cut it, we were overseas, cut off from the mainland, and all our school supplies had to be American. So getting school supplies shipped to, 35 different countries, using 35 different international systems. For one example, one of the commanding generals said, well, we're going to take care of Turkey this year. We're going to make sure that your supplies are dedicated for Turkey. So he arranged for a direct flight for supplies to go to Istanbul and then be redistributed to the schools in Izmir, Karamazov, and Inchirlik. And so we did that by contract. And the Turkish contractor immediately put all the supplies on camel caravans and marched them out of Istanbul across Turkey. So it took days and days and days for the supplies to get there long after school had started. But those are kinds of problems that we dealt with. And then... Parents always wondered, well, will my child fit when he goes back to the States? How will he fit into the school system? One of our tasks was to keep in touch with what's going on with school systems in the United States. So we would have the accreditation people visit us. And one of my jobs was often to get back to meetings of school conventions in America and bring back news of what's going on and communicate back and forth. From the very beginning, when it was determined that there would be schools, and I'm sorry, you hadn't asked me why did we put schools over there to begin with. The decision was that they would never be military schools. They would be American civilian schools taught by American civilian teachers.
Okay.
But the reason that schools were there, and this is a bit of history too, going back as early as 1943, early 44, became obvious that the Allies were going to win the war. It was not sure when that would happen, but the trend was definitely that, hey, this war is going to end and the Allies are going to win it. And the even in Roosevelt's era, they were talking about how they would establish their relations after the war. You've probably read about some of the conferences, Roosevelt, Stalin, and De Gaulle. And with Roosevelt's death and Truman as president, Truman determined that we would send troops to Germany and Japan after the war for a couple of reasons. One is to keep morale high for American families, keep the soldiers engaged and wanting to stay on duty. The other was to show the Japanese and German civilian communities what an American democratic society looks like.
Right.
You may recall or may have heard that the priority attention for America and the Allies in post-war Germany was to restore a free press. You know, the Nazi government had dictated that newspapers and radio stations can broadcast only what we clear.
Right.
Fighting the fake news image of today, the attacks on the press. One of the other priorities was restoring the judicial system. The courts had been remade in Hitler's image. And that made us a little nervous when we began to say, hey, the FBI is interfering in elections, and the Attorney General is comforting the government. You know, when you attack your judicial system, you're undermining the confidence of the public and the judges and the courts. And that was very common in the Germany of 1930s. And the last area was education. Germany had virtually destroyed their collegiate system, their graduate schools, and had remade the elementary and secondary schools in the eyes of the German Nazi regime, the Brown Shirt Party. The kids had to do a military training service. So that's what we wanted to overcome by occupying Germany and Japan after the war. Restore the press, rebuild the university and education systems, and the judicial system. So once General Eisenhower knew that he was going to have families over there, he said, we have to educate them. The local schools can't accommodate them. So we'll have to arrange for schools on our own. So it became a directive to the installation commanders, one of your buildings or facilities will serve as a school.
Wow.
So the schools opened in October of 1946, and they've been there ever since.
Obviously, those sound like all great things, you know, spreading American values to these places in the world. Was there any pushback, though, like that you experienced directly, possibly, from the locals in those places?
Not till the Vietnam era. Early on, most of the nations where we were present, of course, we defeated Germany and Japan, so we imposed our troops on them. But as NATO was formed, we were invited into Turkey and France and England and other NATO nations. Yeah. So we were there at their invitation. And there was still so much gratitude for America's role in ending World War II. Mm-hmm. Resistance was very little. Then it began to be a little humorous. You know, you're trying to turn us all into Coca-Cola drinkers and Camel cigarette smokers and hamburger eaters and other. And it was mostly good humor at the time. But gradually, as we had our own problems with race relations and drug use and Vietnam, more protests, and there were neighborhoods and communities abroad where there was resistance. But even so, I recall shortly after we sent a new iteration of nuclear museums into or nuclear weapons into Germany, there were student protests, and my wife and I were walking in Karlsruhe one afternoon, German city where school headquarters was, and we met some German students out with their banners, and we just stood and watched them until one of them realized that we were speaking English to one another and came over and asked if we were American. We said we were. And I said, what's going on here? He said, well, you know, you're bringing these missiles over here in our territory. So he said, we've got groups today in Berlin and Frankfurt and Paris and Madrid and Washington, San Francisco. And I said, I didn't hear you say Prague or Warsaw or Moscow. No, he said, that's very difficult. It's easy to protest in Berlin and Washington. He said, yes, that's, I said, okay. I said, when you guys get to Moscow and Prague, then you won't have to protest anymore. He kind of took that in good spirits. But that was a congenial confrontation, but there got to be some rough ones here and there.
Would it be somewhat deflating for you, knowing how hard you had worked personally to make Dodea what it is and so many people that you know, to see some of those reactions?
To see those reactions, yes. What has bothered me more, especially during the last 4 years, was the disrespect our government seemed to be showing for NATO and the host nations and Dodea. In fact, one of the Dodea direct, I don't know if you had a chance to see the lengthy interview that Dodea made with me a year or so ago.
I did, yes, yeah.
the history of the school. While we were making that tape, the producer said, you know, we have been keeping a low profile with this administration because we didn't want them to know we were here. They seemed mm-hmm. to wreak havoc with everything they touched. So he said, we didn't advertise much that we were running an expensive school system for the Defense Department. So what has troubled me was the fact that, well, NATO's not paying its share, therefore we need to, you know, get out of some of these agreements. Mm-hmm. What they don't realize, NATO doesn't pay, the NATO nations in general don't pay quite as much of a percentage of their annual income as the U.S. does. In the early days, they didn't have it, of course. Today, they're just as affluent as the U.S. But what our politicians who make that claim don't think about is that, let's use Germany as an example. Germany's about the size of Oregon. Mm-hmm. We've dumped 200,000 troops in Germany, and we've said, we need gunnery ranges, we need airfields, we need motor pools, we need housing, we need tax exemptions, we need discounted prices for troops, we need housing for families, we need schools, we need chapels.
Yeah.
And all this is provided by the host nation.
Right.
And I'd like to see what would happen in Oregon if we dumped 200,000 German troops in Oregon and said, give them aircraft, airfields and motor pools and office space and training grounds. And so there's a lot of in-kind stuff that never gets mentioned really when we talk about deploying troops abroad.
Right.
So I've disliked, you know, pulling out of the Paris Accords for climate change, pulling out of the Pacific Trade Agreement, pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal. It was just dumb and angering, and to all the folks who have served over the years building up those things, it's almost insulting.
Right.
So it's that kind of thing more than host nation pushback that that troubles me. It's our own nation turning on itself. You're too young to remember the Aryan educational principles of Nazi Germany. But when I see our own members of Congress talking about creating an Anglo-Saxon caucus, tightening, you know, the principles behind it are very similar to those that we learned about in the Germany of the 1930s. So those kinds of things trouble me a lot. Host nation pushback, our diplomats are clever, good people. They learn how to deal with that. And our school kids, I've never met I guess you're a brat, or have
I? Yes.
I've never met a brat yet who really resented having to live in a foreign country.
Not at all. I don't know any either.
Most of them have learned a different language. They've learned to appreciate different foods, different ways of doing things. And one of the more interesting things we found out through our museum survey that Circe ran, maybe you were part of it.
Yeah.
The core values of a military brat, as we're asking them as adults now, what are you as an adult considering as a core value you formed growing up a brat? And in asking, running that survey, we asked them, if you don't mind, tell us your race or your gender or your ethnic background. One person wrote back and said, hey, no ethnic, no race, just brat. That's all we are, brat. You know?
Yeah.
No other definition. It doesn't matter whether we're black, trans, you know, female, we're a brat. And then that's what I appreciate about the adults we have growing up out of the brat ranks. And we don't have military veterans much in Congress anymore. We don't have them in high political or corporate offices. So we're depending on the brats now to kind of save the international image of the American dream.
Yeah, that's great to hear. Next thing I want to ask you about is just a few historical events that I would just love to hear your perspective on, having lived through them, and things that, you know, I can only read about. What was the civil rights movement like, living through that, seeing that? What was your reaction at the time?
First of all, most of the really active things happened in the States while I was in Europe.
Right.
So I wasn't fully immersed in the United States to the extent that people were actually here on the ground. Yeah. Though I do remember hearing Americans say, wow, you know, they want to get into the military, they want to get into our school. The next thing you know, they'll want to be in our churches. And I heard a lot of disgusting comments like that among some of my peers. I found the military very concerned. I should point out that I was in one of the first basic training units that was fully integrated after World War II.
Wow.
So I was the grassroots as the military grew up into that. And so from the overseas side, we began to, and I'm talking about senior military leadership now.
Yeah.
We began to explore what's going on with our young people today. They don't seem willing to serve. They're using drugs. Mm-hmm. They're avoiding the draft. What's going on? So we hired a couple of professors from California to come over and meet with top senior, I'm talking about general officer staff now, to say, this is what the kids coming out of high school and into our campuses are telling us. And they were helping us understand how the culture was changing, how the movement is evolving, what's happening with the drug culture. So I would say from the military standpoint, we were opening our eyes. We were perhaps not embracing it to begin with, but we were trying to understand it and work with it. And civilian communities, I think, were way behind the military with respect to that.
Wow.
That's my observation from watching it from afar.
What about something I always wish I could have seen? I can look it up on the internet now, but the moon landing, what was that like? Where were you when that happened, and what was your reaction?
In London, the time the first spaceship landed there, my wife and I were living right near the Thames in a little village, they would call it, in London, though actually it was part of Greater London. And it was a full moon, and we looked up and just wondered, is it really up there? And then, of course, our English friends were saying, are you sure? We keep hearing people on America saying, oh, that's out in Arizona. You know, that's not the moon.
They were saying that at the time?
Yeah, it was really exciting. Yeah, but there were, the Flat Earth Society was very vocal about that. And there is such a group, the Flat Earth Society still is. But mostly it was excitement, and the press was just all over it. And then when we had our first man on the moon, Neil Armstrong, and so on, I wasn't in the States when that happened.
Right.
The European impact, and it was terrific.
Yeah, I'm sure that must have been exciting. And two more events I want to ask you about. The tearing down of the Berlin Wall. Where were you at the time, and how big of a deal was that?
I was in France. I had a job working for an American university in Strasbourg at the time. And it came on TV that the wall was coming down. Of course, Cersei and her husband, Bill, were very much engaged in activity along the wall in their career. Whole thing was of great interest to us, but we had French people out in the streets, and the taverns and bars were showing the TV, and there were fireworks, and it was almost like New Year's Eve in our little neighborhood in Strasbourg.
Wow.
It's happened, and we were once again, it reminded me of being in the army band and playing for the celebration of the liberation of the Netherlands. It was the 10th anniversary, and Dutch people were still coming out throwing flowers at us, and I was hugged, you know, my trombone was embraced. Here we had the army's honor guard behind us, and so it was a little bit of a repeat of what we'd seen in World War II, but finally it's happened.
Yeah.
And so I saw a great celebration and a rebirth of love for America again for a short time there in that part of France.
That's tremendous. And then last one, not as, I mean, terrible event, but this was a year before I was born, actually, was 9/11, September 11th, 2001. Where were you at the time? How devastating was that?
I was home in Indiana, and I was at the time president of the Indiana Arts Alliance, an association made up of the leading artists and art gallery and directors of the state. And I had a meeting scheduled that day in Indianapolis. And I got in my car and I turned on NPR and I heard the announcer say there's been a reports of an airplane colliding with the tower in Manhattan. We don't have any information yet. We'll keep you informed. So on my drive to Indianapolis, which took me a little over an hour, with more and more detail coming in on the radio. And when I got to the hotel where the meeting was to take place, all the TVs were on and people were standing around the TVs. I went to the meeting room and there were three or four people there more interested in the TV than in having any sort of meeting. And we all watched the events for a couple of hours and then decided that maybe we better get back to our home bases and take care of whatever we need to take care of. So on my drive back from Indianapolis to our place in southern Indiana, I needed to stop for gas. And every gas station had cars backed up to it off the interstate. And I had enough to get home, and I knew I had enough to get to a local station in the morning. But every station I drove by had long, long lines, just as like in Eastern Europe when we were first able to drive to Eastern Europe. Any station had gas, people lined up to get it. And the next day I drove to the nearest gas station run by a friend of mine who said he hadn't had any deliveries, didn't know when he'd get any. So fortunately, neither my wife or I had to go anywhere, go to work. So we just stayed home watching the TV and called a few people we thought might be affected and got calls from a few people who had been affected. So that was our personal experience during those days.
Wow. I'm curious now, what is something that exists today that you never thought would exist?
Hey, you didn't ask me about the Cubs winning the World Series.
that's a fair one. That one took a while, please. What was it, 100 years?
108 years, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, dear, something that I never thought would exist. I never really thought we'd have people on the moon or talking about going to Mars.
Yeah.
To think about having the internet, I didn't know enough about technology to know whether there'd be an internet. Mm-hmm. Yet I became aware as we were living in Europe that especially in France, they had these digital connections possible. It was nothing like the internet, but it was close. Wow, what did I think would happen? That's a question I've never really pondered.
Yeah. I just...
Yet I wondered if I would ever get to fly in an airplane.
Wow.
That was amusing to me because going up even into high school, every time a plane flew over our house, we'd run outside to look up at it and wonder, hey, will I ever get to ride in it? And then 30 years later, I was invited to give a speech to the Pan American Pilots Association. So I looked out at an audience of about 75 pilots and said, do you realize you're looking at a man who, as a child, would run outside every time he heard an airplane just to look up at it and wonder if he'd ever get to ride in it?
Wow. Yeah, that's incredible. Is there anything that concerns you about the future as of today, technology related, not technology related?
There are two things that trouble me a lot these days. One is the indifference in general to the threat of climate change worldwide. Yeah. Politically, economically, I don't think our country especially, but a lot of other countries are not seriously enough engaged in recognizing this as a threat. The other is partially political, partially economic, I suspect, and that's the underlying malaise troubling a large percentage of our population who is attempting to undermine government, constitution, our traditions, our values, and getting away with it. And I'm troubled by the gun culture. And I don't want to give lip service to, oh yeah, I respect the Second Amendment, because I don't think James Madison had anything like what we have today in the gun culture in mind. But we seem to have developed a tolerance for these mass shootings. Even today, as you and I were tuning in, I heard reports of still another one in the Midwest. So I'd say those three things are most troublesome to me are, I don't want to limit it to just white supremacists, but our core of undermining our traditions and our values and our hopes and dreams on the one hand, climate change worldwide, and the gun culture. Those things trouble me probably more than anything else.
Yeah. So last thing I want to get to, actually two more things. The Museum of the American Military Family that your daughter ended up founding and I have had the privilege of working with in the past few months. What was your role in the early days of the museum?
She tells me that she mentioned it to me once and I didn't offer any serious response. But she says a couple months later, she said, you asked me when I was going to start it because you wanted to help me.
Yeah.
So I guess a helpmate and a supporter to begin with.
Yeah.
And a gopher is everything else, you know. So she refers to me sometimes as a co-founder. That probably is partially true. But I have supported the idea. I have been proud of her and of the museum. I've been proud to be engaged with it. Sometimes I wonder if my energy can keep up with my 91 years, but it seems to click on. And my wife says I sometimes favor the museum to housework. But I've never been a real fan of housework in any case. So I have to say, I'm proud of the museum. And I was glad to hear that she found someone like you to kind of liaise with the Brat community and bring a youthful perspective to it. And you asked me if I've been participating in anything I had never envisioned. Podcast is one of those things.
I bet.
No, I give high marks to the museum and the few people who have helped out with it. And we're looking for a real future. We do need a permanent home. We need sustainability, and you're aware of that. And we're looking for avenues to achieve both.
Do you have a favorite part about working with the museum and the history?
I have a bias toward the school section,
the section,
because that was such a big part of my life. Mm-hmm. And I guess as people come to me, they think I've been a big part of the school system. So I kind of favor our little gallery dedicated to the history of the school system and the people who worked in it. When we were first getting solicited words of encouragement, Colin Powell, General Powell, told us that the hardest job he ever had in the Army was chairing a local school board.
Yeah.
So all his wars and all his combats and all his other missions were nothing compared to the school community. And Jill Biden, Dr. Biden, as when she was second lady and organized joining forces with Michelle Obama, sent us a message of encouragement. And I just heard that she and Michelle are reactivating joining forces. So we want to get a hold of Dr. Biden now and say, hey, give us another pat on the back.
Yeah, that'd be phenomenal.
Yeah, I like the museum. I like interacting with people who come to the museum, which hasn't been very often during the pandemic. But I am proud of it and glad to be part of it. And as one of the founders, as Cersei would say, welcome.
Yes.
And appreciate your help.
Yes, I also love being a part of it. So it's great to hear that. I had a few questions sent in from my listeners that they had for you. I told them I was going to be having a veteran from World War II on the show. And if you don't mind, I'd just like to share a few of them with you. Pretty interesting. One comes from Maddie. She's a high school student in Dodea in Okinawa, Japan. And she asks, what is something you think that is important for our generation to remember from the past?
Good question.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should remember and never forget the terrible impact of slavery on the scars mm-hmm. we left on our nation, and how difficult, but how exciting it has been to overcome that scarring, and how it's a never-ending conflict, and whether our fear of otherness survives or not is largely dependent on people like Maddie, who's overseas, a third world culture kid. And as I said earlier, we're counting on brats who learn that there are other peoples and other races and other countries and other ways of doing things and other kinds of food to eat. If you as a brat and as a Dodea student can help keep that feeling alive that we are one world, I'd say that's one of the best lessons you can learn.
That's a great message, yes. Next one comes from Bob. He was a friend of mine that I went to middle school with, but now he's in the Army and he's stationed in Alaska. He asks, how does training today fare versus back then? I'm not sure how much you know about the differences, but if you have any insight on that.
Only in general.
Yeah.
My Army, that of post-World War II, you know, the early days after World War II, was largely physical. You know, we trained with rifles and bayonets, and we drove tanks and jeeps, and we fired big guns, and we fired boomerangs. Computers hadn't come along yet. If you could bash steel, you could, you know, change a tire, you could be a soldier. And for a lot of people who are unemployed, the Army was a means of employment. Today, you need almost a couple of degrees to qualify to operate the machinery in the Army, in the military in general. And so I would say the biggest change is in technology. I still advocate physical conditioning.
Yeah.
Because that makes you, I suppose, even a better keyboard puncher.
I guess so. I
think the biggest difference is certainly technology and use of digital technology.
Yeah.
My neighbor here in New Mexico, she was watching my grandson and me try to install a Ring doorbell. He's pretty good at it. He's recently out of the Army, and as you saw at the beginning of the show, my tech support guy.
Yes.
So she was off to work. All she does is track all of the drones we have in the sky. She works at Kirtland Air Force Base for one That's of neat. The laboratories. And her job is to track these drones that circle the world and carry out our military missions. So she thought our little technical job was rather humorous. But it's the drone culture now. The driverless cars, that's the big difference.
Yeah. I hope to be working with drones a lot in the future as well. That's what my degree is geared towards. So something I ask all of my guests, and absolutely no exception for you, is what's next for you? I mean, you have your involvement with the museum, but what do you hope to accomplish?
I hope to reach age 100.
Yeah.
Not too far off, but no, I want to see this museum through. I want to see it find a home and find a future. And I'm dedicating just about all of my free time and such energy as I have left to that. It's the only museum of its kind that's telling this kind of story. And you may not think the story is particularly important, but as I shuffle through some of our archives of personal letters written during World War I, for example,
yeah,
the earth-shaking letters, no, not necessarily, but they're a record of what was important to families back then, particularly families who had been separated by military deployments. And what were they writing about, and how does their writing shape what is happening today? You know, when World War I was happening, women couldn't vote in this country, and some states couldn't own property, and some of the correspondence that we read through reflect that. And so there is a place for a reservoir of material like we have, and there are a couple of university researchers who have discovered this and make regular trips here to thumb through what we have. And it may not be world-shaking, but it is instructive. And so I want to see us develop a place that people really recognize and honor and feel comfortable in.
Yeah, that'd be tremendous. I encourage everyone who is listening to submit a story as well. You're working on the Dodea Anthology, the 75th anniversary.
Yeah, we've got 65 contributions now.
That's great.
Yeah, we'd like to have 75. So we don't have 65 authors. We have closer to 50 or 55. I haven't done a count yet. Some people have sent two or three stories. But we're up, I think we're up to about 65 now.
That's great to hear. Yeah, check out all the museum projects. I'd like to thank you for coming on the show. And this was a great conversation. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, Shannon, and keep this dialogue alive.
I'll do my best. Thank you.
You know what the podcast is now.
Yes.